From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
So indeed, Dr. Betty Shabazz has made a transition, but she is very mighty where she is. She's boundless where she is. She is strong where she is. She will certainly have our back where she is, but she'll also have her eye on you.
Betty Shabazz, widow of Malcolm X, is dead at the age of 61. We'll play the last recorded interview with her just 2 weeks before the fire. Then we'll speak with Merle Evers Williams, whose husband was also assassinated, and Malcolm X's brother, Wilfred Little. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Supreme Court yesterday handed prosecutors a victory in the Whitewater dispute. Justices refused to hear an administration challenge to a decision ordering White House lawyers to turn over notes of private conversations with Hillary Clinton. Meanwhile, the court, in an important church-state ruling, voted 5-4 to reverse a 1985 decision and allow public school teachers to conduct remedial classes in private religious schools. The vote appears to signal a willingness to allow public funds to be used for activities by religious groups. The court also voted 5-4 to allow states to keep certain sex offenders in prison after their sentences are heard. In a blow to efforts to privatize public services, justices also ruled 5-4 that private prison guards aren't entitled to all legal protections government workers enjoy. Senate Republicans have abandoned a proposal to require higher Medicare deductibles for the wealthy and will substitute a plan to have them pay higher premiums. Meanwhile, the Congressional Budget Office says 500,000 children will get Medicaid under expansion plans in the budget deal, not the 5 million children projected by the administration. Cambodia has asked the United Nations to set up a tribunal to try Pol Pot, reportedly in the custody of rival Khmer Rouge forces, for crimes against humanity and the deaths of an estimated 1.7 million people under his regime of the 1970s. A full judicial accounting of atrocities the Khmer Rouge committed is unlikely. President Clinton has unveiled several administrative initiatives aimed at improving urban slums, though many question those proposals. We'll talk more about that later in the week. And European leaders press the United States to accept firm targets for cutting carbon dioxide emissions to fight global warming. President Clinton refused to give such assurances at the weekend G7 meeting, but the campaign continued yesterday with the opening of the big UN conference on the environment. Britain's Tony Blair said poor nations won't act unless rich ones do. And you're listening to Democracy Now!
So indeed, Dr. Betty Shabazz has made a transition, but she is very mighty where she is. She's boundless where she is. She is strong where she is. She will certainly have our back where she is, but she'll also have her eye on you. And thank you for your support.
That is Atala Shabazz, eldest daughter of the 6 daughters of Betty Shabazz and Malcolm X, announcing yesterday the death of Dr. Betty Shabazz outside Jacoby Hospital in New York. Dr. Shabazz died of third-degree burns at 2:46 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The widow of Malcolm X was 61 years old. Later in the show, we'll talk with 2 people who knew her well. We'll speak with Merle Evers Williams, the widow of Medgar Evers and Wilfred Little, Malcolm X's brother. Merle Evers Williams told me last night that Dr. Shabazz have been through the fire in so many different ways through the years. Evers Williams visited the hospital several times over the last 23 days since the last fire and told Atala, Dr. Shabazz's daughter, "Your mother's not quite through yet." In that 3 weeks, prayers and wishes poured in throughout the world. Betty Shabazz grew up in Detroit. She married Malcolm X in 1958. In February of 1965, the family survived the firebombing of their home in Queens, New York. It was 1 week later. She was 30 and pregnant with twins when she and her four young daughters sat in the Audubon Ballroom and watched in horror as Malcolm X was gunned down. Shabazz went on to raise her children in Mount Vernon, New York, got her bachelor's degree, went on to become a nurse, and in addition to other degrees, got a Ph.D. in education from the University of Massachusetts. At the time of her death, Dr. Shabazz headed the Office of Institutional Advancement and Public Relations at Medgar Evers College in Brooklyn, part of the City University of New York. Yesterday, at the news conference, Percy Sutton was questioned. He is an attorney and close friend of the Shabazz family, and he is representing Malcolm Shabazz. Malcolm is the son of the second oldest daughter, Kabila, and he is accused of setting the fire that eventually led to the death of Betty Shabazz. Percy Sutton was questioned about the possibility of the charges against Betty Shabazz's grandson being elevated to murder.
How much, with regard to the question that the Westchester County Attorney's Office had said that these charges against this child, Malcolm Shabazz, the grandson of Dr. Betty Shabazz, will be upgraded to murder, I can only answer, it is a sad commentary that this family, with all that it has suffered all of these years, should now, at a time of distress like this, suggest that they would need to upgrade the charges. For what difference will it make except an added burden upon this family to now upgrade the charges when the result of all of it, no matter what, would be a maximum of 1.5 years of penalty to the child. And I do not believe this is a child who needs that kind of attention, nor is this a place to do it. This is sad enough already. Thank you very much.
That was Percy Sutton, the attorney for Malcolm Shabazz. The former mayor of New York, David Dinkins, is also representing Malcolm Shabazz. We now turn to the last broadcast interview Dr. Shabazz ever did. It was about a month ago, on May 19th, what would have been Malcolm X's 72nd birthday. Bernard White and I co-host the morning show on Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. We called Dr. Shabazz just before she left to speak at a school in New Jersey named for her husband, and then head to the church, Child's Memorial in Harlem, where Malcolm X's funeral was held. It was the only church that would receive his body. He was expelled from the Nation of Islam, and the mosque would not take him. Here is what Dr. Betty Shabazz had to say just 2 weeks before the fatal fire. She talked to us about her life with Malcolm X, his death, and his assassinations. We had just played a speech of Malcolm X's.
Good morning. How are you? Is this Mr. Bernard White?
Yes, it is.
Okay. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. I'm here with Amy Goodman.
Good morning, Dr. Shabazz.
How are you, Ms. Goodman?
Good.
Okay.
Okay.
It's always hard to break into a speech of Malcolm X. Listeners before were saying, why did we cut it off and we had to do it again? But that's just a testament to the power of Malcolm X as a speaker.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the things is that a lot of things are just in print as we speak about Mobutu and Zaire. And yet we hear him talking about him 32 years ago.
Yeah, we're going to hear
is that profound or what?
Quite.
Okay, all right. Hey, he should have been a foreign policy advisor.
Under different circumstances, I'm sure he would have been.
Okay. He was a great guy. He was a great guy. And one of the consolations that I have is that people have grown to such an extent that their conceptual framework has been broadened, and they now understand where he was coming from. At least some of the thinkers understand where he was coming from, and I am very grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your reflections on this day?
My reflections every day. Every day I'm reminded of this guy, okay? You know, I was reared in Detroit, Michigan, with not a very ethnic kind of upbringing, but yet it was. And so that my whole reflection on the historic condition of our people all over the world certainly comes from Malcolm. And I think that when you are talking about living in a society where, you know, everyone is enjoying the fruits of their labor and enjoying freedoms and being able to work and live where you want to live and go to school and have all those opportunities and options, you know, never really entered my mind. My parents reared me to be happy and reared me with the thought of going to school and for myself, and so that the extent of my globalness certainly came from Malcolm.
We were just listening to the speech right after your house in Queens was firebombed. We believe it was the next day, where he was talking about, actually just about now, going into the part about the Congo. Could you set the stage for this time?
Well, number one, you know, there was such confusion about his philosophy. Some were saying he was too religious, and I think there's even in the speech where he says, you know, for the political, I'm too religious, and for the religious, I'm too political, and for something, I'm too worldly. You know, he was like walking on a tightrope. But there were several things that was happening at that time, and one very important one was that there was fear that the leader, Elijah Muhammad, would not be able to carry on much longer, and the one at the forefront was Malcolm, and he would take over. That was as far as from his mind as we are from any distal part. His main agenda was helping black people, and he didn't care if it was Elijah that was at the head of it or his son Wallace. He just wanted to help. One of the things is, you know, that when Malcolm came out of prison and joined that movement, they only had four mosques and cities populated by very senior members. And before his expulsion from the movement, they had a mosque in every major metropolitan city, and a lot of people don't really look at that or focus on that. They always look at Malcolm and say that he was aggressive and he wanted to take over. He didn't want to take over. He wanted to help. And, of course, after he got married and had children, his role strengthened in terms of what he wanted to do to help change the world.
Mm-hmm. On February 20th of 1965, in a telephone conversation with Alex Haley, Malcolm said that the more I keep thinking about this thing, the things that have been happening lately, I'm not at all sure it's the Muslims.
Well, let me just tell you, Alex kind of took, what do you call that,
creative license?
Yes, absolutely. And he did that after Malcolm's assassination.
Mm-hmm.
Malcolm said from the beginning that it would be the black Muslims in coordination with the government. He never changed. That was Haley's part that he put in there. One of the things he was saying that he only trusted one woman, and that was me. Alex put it to four. I don't know who the other three were supposed to be. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But, no, he was a thinker. Why would he at the last minute say that he wasn't sure that the black Muslims were the only one involved. He knew from the very beginning who it was. He had been told who it was.
Mm-hmm. Did you get any indication that the government was also involved?
Let me just say that I always repeat what my husband said. He said that the government, along with the Black Muslim movement.
And we're talking to Dr. Betty Shabazz on the 72nd anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X.
Dr. Shabazz, do you think that in your lifetime you will ever find out exactly what happened?
Of course.
How do you think that will, that information will
come out? Well, I certainly don't want to discuss that at this point, but of course.
Mm-hmm. Over the last couple of years, there have been a whole resurrection of Malcolm through folks wearing Malcolm X hats and Malcolm X T-shirts and a lot of things with Malcolm, commemorating Malcolm X. And I was just wondering what you thought about that.
I'm not opposed to it, you know. A lot of people feel that they get strength from Malcolm,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I can remember when our house was firebombed. And I found an old hat of his, you know, that he had gotten when he had gone abroad during the winter. And I put it on. I felt very strong, you know. It's, no one says anything to other youngsters that put on T-shirts for whatever, you know, reason. If people want to wear it, why not? Free country. If you want to wear it, wear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a wonderful thing. One of the beauties that I see is that, you know, as you go across the country, all across the country, there are people that are wearing these shirts, and I always thought that that was a...
Well, I went to South Africa.
No kidding.
I went to South Africa, and I had taken a plane and gone up to Durban, and my host was having a little luncheon for me at one of the hotels right on the water, and... getting out of the car, you know, I certainly had not focused on myself or my husband or my family. I was, you know, you're tired, you're wondering why you have to go to this luncheon, you know. And there was this guy who had on a Malcolm X T-shirt, and I went, you know, where did you get that from? And he says to me, you know, where did I get what from? And I said, your T-shirt. He says, I have several T-shirts just like this, and I also have hats like that. And I said, hey, right on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wanted to know, you know, why is she so concerned about my T-shirt, you know? I have lots of them, you know. So I said, that's the widow. And he went, oh, and so he runs over and hugs me, you know.
Yeah.
But I said to him, you know, because at that particular time, independence had not come, mm-hmm. okay? And I said to him, you cannot hug me here. I'm not going to jail. You know, he was Dutch or something or other. I don't know what he was. But anyway, you know, I wasn't about to be going to jail. And, you know, you look good in your T-shirt. Let's shake hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I found is, and I generally ask whenever there was I got in contact with someone involved in the liberation struggle in Africa, everyone that I spoke to always knew who Malcolm X was.
Well, they, you know, they read about him. If you look at Malcolm's autobiography, he even talks about that Nelson Mandela had been jailed, and a lot of people at that particular time didn't even know who the world Mandela was, you know, in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I am astounded at his knowledge base of our people all over the world, you know. And even just like now, some 32 years later, we are learning about Mobutu. And it was in his book 32 years ago when he talks about Mozambique and Angola, you know. About 5 years ago, people were saying, what, where is it? You know, he talked about it. So, I mean, he number one, he was very bright, but it is unfortunate that what happened. I think that had he lived, this world certainly would be a far different place. You know, his his agenda certainly was on time.
You're listening to Dr. Betty Shabazz. In the last interview recorded with her, we recorded it at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. I'm Amy Goodman here with Bernard White, who did the interview. We did the interview together. We're going to go back to that interview. Dr. Betty Shabazz died yesterday at the age of 61. And then we're going to speak with Merle Evers Williams and Malcolm X's brother, Wilfred Little, the brother-in-law of Betty Shabazz, when we're done with this interview. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. With Bernard White, we conducted this interview just almost 2 weeks before the fatal fire that Betty Shabazz finally succumbed to yesterday. She died at the age of 61. The doctor of education was fighting for 23 days for her life. We're going to go back to the interview and then speak with Merle Evers Williams and Wilfred Little about this great woman. The interview was conducted on May 19th on what would have been the 72nd birthday of Malcolm X.
Did you witness him absorbing that information? Did he read a lot around the house?
He was an avid reader, and he developed that while he was in prison. Now, Spike Lee says that Elijah Muhammad's followers in prison taught him to go to the dictionary. That was untrue. There was a black American who was a professor who was in prison. And Malcolm respected his ability to talk about almost anything and everything in a very clear way. He enjoyed his use of the language. And based on his admiration for this guy and his knowledge base, he went to the dictionary and started studying. When I married him, he could read any difficult book in 3 or 4 hours. You know, it would take me a couple of weeks to read it. Well, I had to keep stopping to take care of the children and the whole nine yards. But I basically read about 2 books a month. But he could read in 4 hours. He could finish any difficult book. So yes, he did. One of the things when he was in Massachusetts, some white guy died and left his library to that prison and a lot of the classics, and so that Malcolm read 7/8 of those books, so that he was, of course, an avid reader. And I think it's remarkable. He certainly was brighter than I am and a lot of other people.
You know, we've seen a lot of documentation and documents declassified in terms of the John Kennedy assassination, in terms of the Martin Luther King assassination. Of course, not all, but a lot. How about in terms of your husband's assassination?
What about it?
How much has been released in terms of, you know, the CIA and all government documents around?
Well, a number of people have gotten that information. Of course, you know all of the names and and some other information have been blocked out, but I have not requested it, don't want it, don't feel that the majority of it is true. One of the things we know that informers, if they couldn't find anything, they would make up things. When Malcolm was in Africa the first time, his first trip, when he would go down to breakfast in every area that he would go to, every country that he would go to, there was this guy who was always there. And my husband sometime had a humorous streak about him. He was late one morning going down to get his coffee, and the guy was sitting there real pensive, you know, wondering, did he leave? And my husband went by his table and said, I fooled you this morning, didn't I? You know, and the guy laughed. But there were people who said that we have been paid to, we are paid to observe you, to watch you, to see what you do, that I wished I could do the things that you're doing, and would praise him for what he was doing and that he was doing no harm.
Following the assassination,
I wonder, though, why would somebody pay money? Of course, they paid money to ladies to try to entrap him, and I mean, he would share it with me. It was just, you know, we could do better with taxpayers' money.
Oh, for sure. Following the assassination, though, life for you was no crystal steer. It was kind of rough there for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, six children. I had four. 6 months later, you know, God saw to it that I had two more. You know, I wonder what was all of that about. You know, I couldn't handle one. And then I had two. And I can remember Juanita Poitier had gotten her baby crib for me, which was a real large baby crib, and had put the buntings on it and the this and that and little toy at the top, you know, little carousel type toy at the top. And then I had two babies, and we were wondering, what are we going to do? We got to get another bed, you know, we got to go through decorating this bed all over again. And next door was Dr. Barnett, who had twins. And I said, you know, what are you going to do about a crib? And she says, the babies came early. We're not concerned about it. I'm going to give up a dresser drawer. My husband's going to give up a dresser drawer. And we're going to put pillows in these dresser drawers. And when I get strong enough to go out and shop for cribs, that's what I'll do. And I said to Juanita Poitier, listen here. I shared the story of the Dr. Barnett and what her husband had said. And I said, buy an extra bunting, some more blankets, and put the bunting at the foot of the bed. And, you know, this it was a huge baby bed, so that they looked lost in this big bed. So they stayed there until, I guess, they were about 4 months. So, you know, God is good. It was rough, but I made it. I made it because I had very good friends. I didn't have a lot, but I had some friends I had were good, and they span the ethnic and economic and social levels, and they are still friends today, and I am very grateful, very grateful.
Good. Well, we're grateful that they were there for you and that you're still here for us.
Well, you know, got to walk in his footsteps. You know, basically, when you look at what he was about, international sisterhood, brotherhood, still valid, human rights for our people, and not just singularly for our people, but for all people. But somehow, our people are always left out when you get to the finish line. So the human rights for our people and our ability to understand self-defense and self-determination, educational skills and professional career development for men as well as women, and that we should take responsibility for our lives. I think the brother was on time myself. It's understandable that a lot of people had problems with Malcolm's philosophy, because he was talking about people doing it for themselves and being able to control your own resources in your own country. You know, they are talking about market value, maximizing or market maximizing values, and yet we know that there is no justice. The resources are not being adequately paid for. The people live in countries where they have rich resources, and they are not getting their full dollar. And yet these countries are poor. We know that personally they have not been allowed the same kind of freedom as individuals in other countries, you know. So I can understand. They said that it was he was interfering with the resources of America, but now I see that we are moving towards some sort of equilibrium or equity in terms of payment and that sort of thing. So I guess if you live long enough, you'll see it happen.
Mm-hmm. And what have you been doing? You you started a, was it a medical fund?
No. I didn't start it, you know.
You're on the board.
Pardon me?
You're on the board then.
No. What happened is I helped. Okay. And there is, of course, the Malcolm X Medical Scholars program at Columbia University. And I was told that as of this June, we have 21 medical doctors working, you know, finished their internship and residency. And it's just 2 students per year. But they have a commitment to work wherever they want to work, of course, but to pay particular attention to those underserved individuals, regardless to ethnicity. We're very happy about that, but we also have some grade schools and high schools that are turning out youngsters as bright in education as Tiger Woods is in golf, you know. And what we have to understand is that it is important to educate the mind, to help people be able to make decisions and understand that youngsters who are failing could be passing. And part of that is our responsibility, not just theirs alone.
Okay.
Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us this morning on this day that is the anniversary of your husband's birth. He would have been 72 years old today.
Oh, my God! You know, I can't believe it. I can't believe it, you know. I never really, you know, looked at him as, you know, age. I looked at him as, you know, this person. My mother had a problem. She thought he was too old for me. I thought he was just right for me. Listen, his brother was just right for me. But yeah, when you say 72, then I think of my mother, and I say, oh, wow, yeah. Well, you know, she had a point there. But but what they say, age is but a number. And I am delighted that I had the opportunity to share part of his life, because he was a great guy.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Betty Shabazz.
Thank you, Mr. Bernard White and Ms. Amy Goodman. It's been a pleasure talking about this guy that I love so much.
Oh, okay, good. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Dr. Betty Shabazz on May 19th, on what would have been the 72nd birthday of her husband, Malcolm X, speaking to us almost 2 weeks before the fatal fire that she has died of as of yesterday at 2:46 in the afternoon Eastern Standard Time. It was the last broadcast interview that she did.
The 23rd Psalm is sung by Bobby McFerrin, dedicated to his mother. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Bernard White. Bernard, we certainly didn't know on May 19th that this would be Betty Shabazz's last interview.
No, we didn't, Amy. One of the things that I thought was very significant about the 19th, and we were very fortunate in that Dr. Shabazz did not give many interviews around the 19th, and I thought that I thought it was strange that we were able to get her, because generally I had stopped trying, but it seems that she had begun to open up quite a bit, and you could tell that in the interview that she was very relaxed. There were a few moments there where she just wanted to make things clear, but for the most part she was very relaxed and very willing to share.
Lighter than I'd ever heard her, really.
Yeah.
Some have said that she was talking about writing a book.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that that's a real tragedy, in that we won't, that book right now won't be written by her, and that story that she has to tell, that she knows better than anybody else, it won't be told, and that history that she experienced will go unreported. There may be others who will come together and try and piece it together, but we won't hear it from her. And she, I'm sure she has some insight that she's been holding for years that I wish she would have been able to share.
Yeah. Well, in a minute, we're going to be joined by her brother-in-law, Wilfred Little, Malcolm X's brother in Detroit, who saw her just a few weeks before she died when she came to Detroit. But first, we're going out to Oregon to speak with Merle Evers Williams, who's the chair of the NAACP. She had a deep bond with Betty Shabazz, forged through loss and survival. Both women lost their husbands, Medgar Evers and Malcolm X, to assassins' bullets, and both went on for their children and for a country that needed them very much. In fact, Merle Evers Williams, you were planning to get together with Betty Shabazz and Coretta Scott King the weekend of the fire, weren't you?
Yes, indeed we were. One week after the fire, where my sister was so severely burned, the three of us, Betty, Coretta, and I were scheduled to meet each other in Miami, in what would have been our second retreat. A retreat where we would just simply be. No persona for the public, just down to earth, as Betty said, and she was so down to earth, just a good old do-it girl kind of thing. And I could not help but think, as I was very fortunate to visit her, I'm not sure that Betty knew that I was there, but on that same Sunday, that it was going to be a Sunday of joy, relaxation, starting off for an entire week, and there I was visiting her at a bedside. It's very difficult because on one hand, those of us who care so much about her, those who didn't know her, did not want her to suffer. Yet we kept hoping for the best, and I found myself really confused as to what to ask for in prayer. And I finally just said, God, your will be done. Your will be done.
We're talking to Merle Evers Williams, and we're going to be back with her and Wilfred Little in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, broadcast from Washington to Florida, from Hawaii to Maine, from California to New York, and a lot of places in between who care about Betty Shabazz, who died yesterday, and the legacy that she leaves. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Lord is my shepherd, I have all I need. She makes me lie down in green meadows beside the still waters. She will be. She restores my soul. She rights my wrongs. She me in a path of good things and fills my heart with songs. Even though I walk through a dark and dreary land.
This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Bernard White, our guest on this very sad day, the day after Dr. Betty Shabazz has died in New York at the age of 61. Our guests are Merle Evers Williams, chair of the NAACP, a friend of Betty Shabazz for many years, and also Wilfred Little, Malcolm X's brother and Betty Shabazz's brother-in-law. He lives in Detroit, rarely speaks publicly. He saw Dr. Shabazz a few weeks before the fire when she came to speak to a group of students in Detroit.
Hi, Wilfred.
Good morning. Hello.
When was the last time that you saw Dr. Shabazz, and what are some of your thoughts about thoughts you're having today?
Well, about 2 weeks before the fire, she was here to speak to some students at the Malcolm X Academy. And it was a case of where these children were about to graduate, and they had a little banquet for them and had her to come in and speak to them. And she gave them a motivational talk that evening and made them aware of some of the things that they would have to face in the present world and in the future, you know, and to how to get themselves prepared so that they would be able to take their place or at least make a place for themselves.
You know, one of the things that makes this such a significant day in African-American history, if not U.S. history, is that Dr. Shabazz was the first of three very prominent wives of leaders who were slain in this country, and that alone is a very significant thing. She's the first one to die, and I was wondering just what you, Merle Evers, was thinking about in relationship to that.
Oh, it's and let me say good morning to everyone. I haven't yet. It's still a little early where I am. I can in no way accept the word that Betty is dead, because she isn't. Her physical body may not be with us any longer, but her spirit lives in each and every one of us. I'm not sure I've ever known anyone who could reach across the divide of economics and race, creed, color, standing. She just related to everybody. She had so many friends at so many different levels, and she could keep all of us there together. The bond that I had with her, the bond that Coretta Scott King, Betty, and I share, is unique. She is the first, as you said, to leave of the three of us, as someone described us in a magazine that came out, Upscale magazine that came out in May, the Mothers of the Movement. I can't think of her as being gone, because the lives that she touched, so many more than she even knew herself, the impact that she had on all of us, will just continue to leave. I'm sure that I will talk to her as long as I'm here. when I learned of the news yesterday, I walked out on the deck of the place where I was staying, and I looked at the mountains, and I thought about Betty, and I thought about how much fun she was also, and how we would encourage each other when we were down and out, and how we thought that perhaps our husbands were not getting the credit that they deserved. And she always would come out of those conversations with an upbeat mode, and she would tell me sometimes, go get it, girl, go get it. And as I stood there, and I was looking up at this beautiful blue sky, all I could say right then was, Betty, go get it. Get it, girl. Go on your journey and do what you must do. She's with us. She has left such a legacy. She has impacted so many people. And as long as we can live lives where we impact people in a positive way, one never dies. And I just can't think of her in that way. I will miss the physical, but she'll always be with me, as she will with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people around this world, not just this country, but around the world, not just African Americans, but all people, because we all learned and we grew. We were better people because she existed.
Merle Evers Williams, how did you go on? I assume in your first meeting, formal Mothers of the Movement summit that you had about a year ago with Coretta Scott King and Betty Shabazz, you talked about those painful days right after the assassinations of your husband. All of you had young children. You were very accomplished and went on to accomplish many more things as well. How did you do it? And also having to stand up really for the world and for women of the world to show you could go on.
Well, you know, I can recall and many of our conversations, and this was a very relaxed week that we had together, because we said, this is going to be the first time we're going to be able to be out of the public's eye and just let our hair down and talk as one woman to another, girlfriends, type thing, because we always saw each other, but we were usually with other people around us. And this was just a very relaxed thing, and we found ourselves asking, at least Betty and I, how did we do it? Looking back, we weren't quite so sure how we did it. But as she always recognized people who helped her, she recognized the fact that she didn't do it alone. And I certainly have, and I say this in my speeches as well, that we never accomplish things by ourselves. There's always someone there who has helped us, regardless of whether we know it or not. And it was with that kind of get down, sometimes a few tears, asking questions, how did we survive it? And we just concluded that, one, we had strong religious beliefs. Secondly, that we had men, very strong men, that we loved dearly. That we had their children, and those children motivated us, even when, well, I'll speak for myself, when I wanted to give up, I couldn't do it. Then there were friends that we knew we had, and friends that we didn't know that we had. And we talked about the people that we would meet as we went around the country who would say to us, you've been in my prayers all of these years. It's a coming together of all of that, but really laughing sometimes at the predicaments that we would find ourselves in when we didn't have enough money for clothes or food for our children, particularly with me. And Betty would tease me about this, how I would buy neck bones for those who eat meat, they would know that sometimes neck bones have meat on them, sometimes they don't. And you would cook those neck bones in your peas or your beans or your greens, and then you would take them and
made a great
put sauce on them, you know, and just something to carry us through. But it was never as easy as the public thought that it was for us.
You mentioned the children, and the baton of family leadership will be passed on to Attila, who's the eldest daughter.
Yes.
Wilfred, could you tell us a little bit about Attila?
Well, Attila being the oldest, naturally it seems as though the elder child seems to assume a role in a family among the siblings. I know it was that way with me. I was the eldest in our family. And it seems like the others would look to me in the absence of father and mother to run things past me to see what I thought or things of that kind. For some reason, it seems to be that way. Well, this is the way it is with Attila, and she's very much like her father in many ways. I see a lot of the genes from both sides of the family when I observe her.
She looks like him.
Yes, and I see the genes come through from her mother. I see some of the genes coming through from her father. You know, they're both there, and it's a nice blend.
Wilfred, do you remember when you first met Betty?
Yes. The first time I met her to know her was in, she had come to Detroit, well, she had come, Malcolm had sent for her. They were getting ready to get married. And if I had seen her before that, I never saw her to know her. I'd see her in a group or something like that, and I never knew her individually. But I didn't get to know her until they got married. And then the next time I saw her, she was carrying Attila on her shoulder. And I always tell people it was the oddest kind of a feeling to see her with Attila on her shoulder. And look, it looked like somebody had taken Malcolm and shrunk him. It looked like a shrunken Malcolm that was on her shoulder. Because she had the same color hair, same color, same eyes. And so it was just it seemed so odd to observe that. But I've observed Attila through the years. When she got into her teens, older, she came and stayed with me for a little while. She got to know, and then she went to visit with my sister. My mother was with my sister at that time. So she got to know my mother. And she was very interested in getting to know her father's side of the family. And so we were glad to have her with us, and she got a chance to learn something about us. And we always had a good relationship.
There are powerful women in your family.
Yeah, well, you know, I've heard that before from others. I even going back to my mother's time, my mother had such an influence on us. During the time that my father was living, you couldn't have had a better team. And between the two of them, they gave us most of the things we needed to be able to survive in the environment into which we found ourselves. And it was because of things that my father and my mother taught us that we were able to do this. And my mother continued to do this even after my father's death. She continued to impart these things and make us know how to survive in the world in which we lived and the things that we would have to come to deal with. And this has been helpful to me, especially all my life. I think about her so often, and I think about my father so often. They inbred in us a sense of self-reliance and not blaming others and not talking about what we would do if. We wouldn't dare to say that around our father. If I had this, or I can't this, he'd be right on you right away.
Speaking of what could be done, for all that we know about Malcolm X, Betty Shabazz went through all of that. I mean, when the police raided the house, she was there on the ground with guns to her head.
That's right.
The house was firebombed, she was there with Malcolm trying to get the children out. And she has been, of course, she was there in the Audubon Ballroom at the time with her four daughters, pregnant with her, with the two next daughters, when Malcolm was gunned down. She has been through it all.
Yes. And you know, Betty experienced a lot. We learn, our experiences are our teacher in many cases. We learn, and we have our educational process and all of that. But there's experiences we have that also have an impact on us. And I always say to students that we, as individuals, are a blend of the genes from our father and mother. And if you observe a person a while, you can see this. We are a blend of those genes. But after that, that's what we start out with. But then our environment that we grow up in, the education that we receive, the experiences, all of these things impact upon us to make us the person that we become. So, and back to Betty, a lot of the negative experiences, she had so many of them, just like many of us have had. But those negative experiences, we look at them sometime and feel that it's bad, but when we step back off and look at it from a different perspective, we see that the negative experiences, as well as the positive experiences, are what makes us the person that we become. And a lot of times, these negative things that happen, oh, it's so terrible and so this, that, but after a while, we begin to realize that that negative experience brought about conditions that made it possible for us to grow a little bit more.
Yes.
And to get some other experiences that broadened our minds and made us a much wiser person. Mm.
We are also, our legacy is also what resides in the memories of those who we interacted with. And Merle Evers, before we go, what are you going to tell people about the Betty Shabazz that you knew?
I will tell Betty what I think people already know. What a wonderful person she was, a wise person, a giving person, one who motivated people to do the very best that they could, a deeply insightful woman, a woman full of love and forgiveness. And if I just may mention one thing that's very, very personal, the last time we were together, my son Van, who's a professional photographer, had the assignment of taking a photograph of Betty Coretta and myself for a magazine. And Betty was very, very ill. She got up out of her bed, and she came to that studio for that photography shoot. And she said to Van, come here. Let me give you my germs, she said. You're the only one, my son, that I would get up out of my bed for to do this. And all of us were tired, and Betty did not feel well at all. But by the end of that session, she had us all laughing, and she was dancing. And we had a wonderful time. She was alive. She was full of life, and she leaves that with us, determination to move ahead.
Merle Evers Williams, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And as you said to me last night, she has been through the fire so many times. Betty Shabazz, dead at the age of 61. Her memory lives on. Merle Evers Williams and Wilfred Little, thanks for joining us. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Write to us by email, democracy@pacifica.org. You can hear us on the internet as well at pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Our engineer is Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman with Bernard White. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!